Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello, thanks for joining me for the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, and the show, like the charity, is all about integrative medicine for cancer, an inclusive approach that puts patients at the centre of their own treatment choices. If you're listening to this show, then you're probably someone who notices health-related news, and you probably won't have missed the rise of the microbiome as a news topic. More and more experts are endorsing the vital importance of gut health to overall well-being. One such expert is nutritional therapist Liz Butler, who specialised for many years in supporting people with cancer through nutrition. She recently gave a talk on the microbiome for professionals, which prompted me to talk to her about the subject for today's show. I'm speaking to her in London over Skype.
Hi Liz.
Hi.
Lovely to have you on the show again.
Thank you. Really great to be here.
Yeah, I was inspired to invite you to talk about the microbiome by your recent talk on the subject to professionals at the BSIO, the British Society for Integrative Oncology. It's clearly an extremely important topic that's gaining more and more attention, both in the integrative circles and also within mainstream research. So when I was at school, bacteria, viruses, in fact, any of our smaller life companions were seen as the enemy of clean, healthy living. And we had absolutely no compunction in succumbing to all the TV adverts and massacring them by the millions with Dettol and Domestos. So why should we want to start being a bit more friendly towards these little critters?
Well, the reason we need to do that is because they are so essential for our health. And it's really only in the last decade that scientists have come to realise just how vital they are for our health. For many, many years, we felt that it was good to almost sterilise our environment and use as many products as possible to clean our kitchens and our bathrooms and our entire homes. And, you know, there's so many products in the market now with antibacterial action. And we've come to believe that that's a good thing to clean our environment. But, you know, increasingly we're understanding from the research that some level of microorganisms in our environment is absolutely essential for our health. And scientists are learning more and more about what these microorganisms do. We still have a huge amount to learn. We know that we have many, many of these microorganisms living within us, but we don't yet know exactly what types there are and in what specific amounts. But we do know increasingly that they have an absolutely essential role. You know, without the microorganisms within our body, we wouldn't be able to survive. So yes, they're essential.
It's a very different picture, isn't it? Okay, so you've already said that we don't necessarily know that much about what's going on down there, but we're getting some idea. And you know, it's a tough concept for the Domestos generation, but there's a host of different life forms down there that have taken up residence in our guts. Some of them are helpful, and some of them, as you say, are essential, and some of them are not so. So, out of what we know, can you give us a bit of a whistle stop tour of the inhabitants?
Yeah, sure. So when we're talking about microorganisms, we're talking about living things that are too small to be seen with the naked eye. And they fall into categories. We've got bacteria within us, on us and within us. And by weight, the majority of our microorganisms are bacteria. We also have closely related to bacteria a group of organisms called archaea. And they're very similar to bacteria, but they are slightly different. And then we have fungi, and we also have protozoa, and we also have viruses. And if you're talking about actual particles, we have more viruses than we do anything else. Probably about 10 times the number of viruses to bacteria. But scientists know a lot less about our virome, as it's called, the viruses that live within us, compared with what they know about the bacteria. So as you said, some of them live on and within us, and that they don't either take away or give us that much. But most of the organisms living on and within us, we have a mutualistic relationship with them. So they derive benefit from us, the host, but we also benefit from them. You also have the parasitic microbes, and those, they derive benefit from us, but they don't give us anything back, and actually they can harm us. So, but we generally, if we're healthy, we have a lot less of those. So most of our microbiome, which is the complete makeup of our microorganisms on and within us, that we have this mutualistic relationship with them.
Right, interesting. And it's also interesting to hear that far more viruses than bacteria. I mean, viruses have probably got worse press than bacteria with us generally, haven't they? They're definitely seen as the enemy. There's no such thing as a good virus in anybody's mind, is there?
Yeah, but that's going to change. I really believe that. I think that, you know, we know, as I say, a lot more about how bacteria support our health, but particularly the immune system, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But scientists now know that the viruses, you know, obviously some detrimental to us, but viruses also play an important role in helping our immune system to develop and stay regulated and balanced. So, yes, I think we're going to learn a lot more about that in future, and we will come to see them in a different light. I was just going to say before, I didn't tell you sort of overall figures with microorganisms, and no one knows this, you know, with any real accuracy, but right, it's thought that there are over 30 trillion organisms in and on humans, and thousands of species have been identified so far. So, you know, if you look at it in that terms, we have more microorganism cells within and on us than we do human cells. So that's something quite incredible,
that
I think.
And you talked about the mass of bacteria. Do you have any sort of a guide as to how much weight of other species there are living as, you know, how much of a percentage of our weight is made up of other species?
I don't know exact figures on this, but it's several pounds of bacteria.
Right, a lot.
It's considerable.
Yeah.
I certainly know it's several pounds, so several bags of sugar of weight.
Yeah.
Just think about how many that means in terms of numbers. Huge.
Right, yes. Okay, so can you give us some sort of guide now as to some of the most important functions that the microbiome is performing for our benefit?
Yeah, absolutely. So There are many, many functions. Most of them do centre around the bacteria because that's what we know most about. But there will be functions for the other microorganisms as well. But if we're talking about the bacteria mainly, then you can sort of break it down into categories. And so first of all, we would have the nutritional aspect, and the bacteria within our gut have a very important role in helping us to break down compounds, dietary compounds, and helping us to extract, first of all, energy and calories, but also nutrients. And the bacteria are also responsible for converting compounds into usable nutrients. And we get a lot of B vitamins from the bacteria in our gut. We also get the fat-soluble vitamin, vitamin K, and also certain amino acids. So that's the nutritional role.
Right.
These bacteria also have a metabolic function, and they're involved with the conversion of compounds into other compounds. They're involved in helping us to, as I said, extract energy from carbohydrates and also proteins. They're involved in fat storage. They have a role in appetite control. They're involved in cholesterol production, cholesterol being a very, very important molecule within the body. They're also involved in the metabolism of certain hormones and neurotransmitters, for example, estrogen. So the bacteria that we have within our gut will play a role in how we break down our estrogen. So this can be relevant, of course, in cancers where there is a link with estrogen.
Right.
So that's the metabolic role. And then the bacteria also have a very important role, particularly again in the gut, in helping us to break down toxins. So these may be toxins coming from our external environment, or they may be byproducts of our general reactions within the body. And the bacteria contain enzymes that can break down and detoxify a lot of these chemicals. So that's another important role. And then the other role is about protection and supporting our immune system. And this is an incredibly important role that the bacteria and, as I said, viruses and also the fungi play, is helping our immune system, first of all, to develop when we're babies, mm-hmm. and then to mature through our life. And then to the microbes play an absolutely vital role in helping to keep our immune system balanced. So, you know, making sure that it doesn't become overactive. So then we will be talking about autoimmune diseases, but also that the immune system is not underacting, so that it's responding when it should. And the relationship between our gut microbiome and the health of our immune system is absolutely crucial. I mean, 70 to 80% of our immune system is actually located in our gut. And the interface that occurs around the gut lining. So if we think about the gut lining being the interface between the external world, which is the contents of our gut, yeah. and the internal world, then masses of our immune system is located around that interface, because that's where we come in contact with a lot of potential pathogens and toxins. So our immune system is very active in that area, and it's helping to the microbes are helping to keep our immune system working within fine boundaries. So the body needs to have the immune system working well and in a state of readiness, but it doesn't want it to be overactive, as I said.
Right.
And the microbes are very important in helping to regulate that balance.
Wow. Well, that's quite a tour you've given us there. I mean, that figure of how much of our immune system is dependent on the microbiome is like, well, that's the highest I've heard yet. It seems to be going up all the time. You know, the importance being given to the microbiome in terms of immunity. You've made it quite clear there, just by giving us the headlines, how absolutely indispensable all of these are to just functioning normally. It's mm-hmm. quite a different picture to, you know, us being a complete entity with these invaders, which are a pesky nuisance.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are those invaders that are a pesky nuisance, for
yes.
sure.
Sure.
But if you look at the whole overall picture, then microorganisms are giving us so much more than, you know, damage they may be doing.
Right. Okay, very interesting. Thank you. Okay, so listeners to this show, they've got an interest in cancer, of course, and mm-hmm. that is your specialism too. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the most recent research that's highlighting the the potentially devastating consequences of ignoring your gut health if we have cancer or if we're going through cancer treatment?
Yeah, well, this is a fascinating area. And, you know, I did look into it for this talk that you mentioned earlier. And it was interesting to see that there's now growing research showing that imbalances in the gut microbiome. So this is what we call gut dysbiosis.
Okay.
So when there's a disturbance in the microbiome balance. And this has now been linked to several cancers. You know, most obviously, you would think that there might be a link with colorectal
right.
cancer
sure.
because, you know, if we're talking about the gut, then you can, you know, make that link quite clearly. And, you know, many of the studies have focused in this area. And there is definitely a link between dysbiosis and colorectal cancer. It's not a straightforward picture. So scientists haven't been able to say, okay, if you've got more of that bacteria and less of that bacteria, that's going to increase your risk.
Right.
I mean, they're getting closer to being able to make some links like that. But everyone is different. That's one of the things that I haven't pointed out yet, is that we all have our own microbial fingerprint. And yes, there are common themes. It varies according to many things. Our genetics plays a role, and the environment we've been exposed to when we're young plays a role. But we all have this core microbiome, our resident microbiome, as it's called, that pretty much stays the same for most of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's specific to each person. So when you're studying diseases and trying to work out the relationships between diseases and the microbiome, it is a bit complicated because everyone has a slightly different
right.
microbiome. But what scientists have been able to show is that, generally speaking, there's a marked decrease in diversity of the microbiome, so less species, and that has been linked to colorectal cancer, but not just colorectal cancers, actually. There's also a link with liver cancer, with the gut dysbiosis, and also other cancers. And then the other thing that I really want to point out is it's not just about the microbes in our gut, because we have microorganisms throughout our whole body.
Mm.
And there's also been some interesting studies looking at the balance of microorganisms within our mouth, so our oral microbiome. And dysbiosis here has been linked to, first of all, cancers of the mouth, again, as you probably
obviously,
would expect.
Yeah.
So squamous cell carcinoma in the oral area has been linked to this type of dysbiosis. However, oral microbial dysbiosis has also been linked to other cancers, such as pancreatic cancer.
Mm.
So there's a link with more distant cancers. And then other researchers found that urinary microbiome dysbiosis has been linked to prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Changes with the microorganisms in the lungs has been shown to increase the risk of lung cancer. And then there's been some interesting research looking at breast cancer. And scientists have found that malignant tissue within the breast has a change in the microbial balance compared to healthy tissue within the breast. So looking at women with breast cancer and comparing areas of the breast and healthy and cancerous, and showing that there's a change in the microbial balance. And again, it's the key thing that seems to come out over and over again is a reduction in the number of species. So this lowered diversity, that seems to be sort of the common theme that runs through it all.
Right, which is a symptom of our times. We'll go into that a bit later.
Yes.
Interesting. And tell me, there's potential for sort of cause and effect questions here. You know, it might be said that the dysbiosis is a symptom of cancer, or it might be said that it's a cause of cancer. Is there anything in the evidence that points to it being a cause rather than a symptom?
Well, interestingly, one of those studies that I was talking about where they've linked oral microbial dysbiosis to pancreatic cancer, found that actually the dysbiosis preceded the disease by about 10 years.
Right.
So yes, there's always that question, what comes first? Is it the cancer or the dysbiosis? But this study particularly showed that the dysbiosis came first by several years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and coming back to the emerging evidence, I heard of some trials around the success of orthodox cancer treatments and the state of the gut flora. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, now this is quite early research, but there was some headlines recently, probably about 6 weeks ago, on the news about the link between our microbiome and cancer treatment. Basically, scientists have found that the effectiveness of cancer treatment is in part dependent on the state of our gut microbiome. So scientists have been able to produce germ-free animals. So this is not easy to do, I can tell you, but in a lab, then they can create conditions where they can have germ-free mice or germ-free rats, and they can study those and see, obviously, then, you know, how important our microbiome is for certain things. And they've found that certain chemotherapy drugs will not be nearly as effective if there is no bacteria in the gut. So they've looked at oxaliplatin, for example, and cyclophosphamide, and both of those were found to be very dependent on there being bacteria in the gut. So they're not really at the point yet of showing exactly which bacteria are going to make the chemotherapy more effective, but they do know that the microbiome is very important for the drugs to work, and they've also shown the same with monoclonal antibody treatments as well.
These are the new drugs they're developing.
Yes.
Any theories on why this is the case?
Well, yes, there are some theories. I mean, one theory is that possibly if the gut is a bit leaky, which we generally think is not a good thing, well, we know it's not a good thing, but if the gut is a bit leaky, which basically means that that layer of cells that separates the outside of the world, so that the external environment or the contents of our gut with the internal environment, if that layer of cells is a bit leaky, or that there's gaps in between, then things can pass across in either direction. And if the gut's a bit leaky, then bacteria may start to come into the internal environment, which is not really what we want, generally speaking. But one theory is that if that is happening, and chemotherapy drugs generally will make the gut more leaky, but we find, I certainly find in my work with cancer clients, that very often the gut is a bit leaky anyway, through just general poor health. But if it is a bit leaky, then bacteria can pass across, and that will stimulate an immune response. And it's thought that perhaps in these studies that I've talked about, that the bacteria moving across into and stimulating the immune response is perhaps part of the way that the drugs are working. So if there are no bacteria there that can then leak across the gut as the chemotherapy breaks it down, then there's going to be less of an immune response. So that's one theory, but no one's exactly sure yet.
No, right. Okay. Well, very interesting stuff. So the chemicals industry, it's through lots of great advertising, you know, since the war, has created this wave of revulsion for anything small and wiggly. And in response, it's created a myriad of ways to exterminate and eradicate anything that moves. So on the one hand, you could say this appears to be a good thing, in that not very long ago, infection was really the big number. You know, people were dying from infection in hospitals. And people are living much longer now, but there seems to be a cost. We seem to swap the infections for some much more insidious chronic diseases. And I'd like to know how many of these you think could be directly attributed, at least in part, to poor gut health.
I think very many of them could be attributed. I mean, if you look at a lot of the chronic diseases that have become so common now, then they actually have very similar underlying mechanisms going on. And there's very often changes and disturbances to our immune system playing a role. And as part of that, there's very, very often a level of chronic inflammation going on with a lot of these diseases. And chronic inflammation can be caused through lots of things, but changes to the gut microbiome is a very big factor playing a role in chronic inflammation. So I think that this is a very common feature. And so again, going back to the leaky gut, I mean, apart from it perhaps having a positive role to play in making chemotherapy work more effectively, generally speaking, leaky gut is something we don't want, because if you start to have bacteria or undigested food particles moving across from the external side of the gut into the internal part of our body, then that is going to place a lot of stress on the immune system. The immune system is going to have to keep on generating responses to these foreign invaders. And that over time will, because we only have a finite resource, our immune system only is a finite resource. And if we keep on draining the resource of the immune system, then that's not a good thing. So making sure that our gut, the gut wall is strong and healthy, and the junctions that are called tight junctions between those cells are working properly, is very important. But unfortunately, many things in our modern lifestyle encourage leakiness in our gut. So I think that is a major problem that underlies many conditions. I mean, it's really definitely a big problem in any of the autoimmune diseases, and also the inflammation, as I mentioned, that underlies these diseases. And then, of course, if you're talking about gut health in general, we have all sorts of other issues going on with poor digestion. Stress plays a big part here, that the association and links between stress and gut health are very strong. So if people are under chronic stress, which, as we know, is very common, then they're not going to be producing enough of the hydrochloric acid that we need to break down our proteins. And we're also, if we have high cortisol, we also have less of what's called secretory IgA. So that's a very important immune compound within our gut. So, you know, there's all sorts of problems that go along with a modern lifestyle: stress, poor diet, not taking enough time to sit down and eat a meal properly so that we can digest it properly. And all of this will cause problems within our gut: poor digestion, leaky gut, imbalanced microbiome. And as I said before, by disturbing the immune system, creating inflammation, that is going to feed into all of those chronic diseases that have now become so common.
Okay, well, look, you mentioned some of the things that are contributing, if you like, to this wave of chronic disease we're suffering from. Would you like to just sort of itemize some of the main products that we're buying and using, and pastimes that we're involved in, that we might want to reconsider if we are starting to care about our microbiome?
Well, first of all, if you're talking about products that we're buying, I think it is really important to think about all those antibacterial products that are out there on the market now, and whether we really do need them. I mean, there is this whole hygiene hypothesis that the cleaner we've got and the more sterile our environment has become, the more that chronic disease rates have gone up. And I think, you know, there's something to be said for that. As long as we, you know, using soap, just normal soaps and having a certain level of hygiene, then that's enough. We don't need all these antibacterial wipes and cleaners. It's unnecessary. And as you'll know, and the listeners will know, scientists are becoming increasingly concerned about antibiotic resistance, yes, which is another issue. But the more we use antibacterial products in our environment, the more that that's, you know, going to become a problem. So I think, you know, just use non-toxic, regular, safe, healthy cleaners, good for the environment, good for you, don't need the antibacterial ones. That's the first thing to say.
So that's for personal care and also for your house care and all that kind of thing.
Absolutely, yes, for sure. And there's another thing that people are a growing concern about our microbiome is the effects of electromagnetic radiation. This is something that there's not a great deal of research on yet, but there are experts out there that are saying that this is a problem. Again, with the electromagnetic radiation, it is all a bit of a big experiment what it's doing to our health, but there are experts that are concerned that that is going to disrupt the health of our microorganisms and the balance of our microorganisms, which makes sense really. If it's affecting our normal cells, it's going to be affecting them as well. So I think we can try and limit our exposure as much as possible on that side of things. Of course, medications are going to have a big impact on our gut microbiome. And the most obvious one, of course, is antibiotics. And, you know, these are life-saving drugs sometimes, and they're very necessary sometimes. But I think that we always need to be careful, you know, to make sure that we actually do need them and not to take them, you know, unless we're absolutely certain that it's going to be of benefit. And I think, you know, these days doctors are more careful about prescribing them, luckily. So we're not likely to have them handed out willy-nilly like perhaps we were before. But it isn't just antibiotics. There are other medications that are linked to unhealthy changes in the gut microbiome, and they include things like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which, you know, again, sometimes they're very necessary, but other times we may use them, you know, when we don't really need to. So that's something to think about. Smoking has been shown to alter the microbiota, particularly obviously within the lungs. So has alcohol. Been shown to upset our gut microbiome. Other pollutants in the environment, things like organic pollutants from pesticides and heavy metals, have also been shown to upset the balance of the gut microbiome. So we can, you know, just make sure that as much as possible, and of course this is helpful for our health in general, is just to minimize exposure to those sort of toxins. So going organic and being careful about, you know, if we're exposed to heavy metals in any way. Yeah. So yeah, there's plenty we can do. I mean, there's this great quote which I really like from a scientist. His name's Justin Sonnenberg. And him and his wife, I can't remember her name, her surname's Sonnenberg again, but they're a husband-wife research team in America. They've done some brilliant research on the microbiome, and they've now written a couple of books for the layperson, which Richard really recommended. But one of his quotes is, "Just because the system is complex, it doesn't mean that the solution for having a healthy microbiota needs to be complex." Right. Yeah. The system is so complex and we still know, you know, relatively little. But the thing that I like to point out to people is everything that's good for us, our human cells, will also be good for promoting the health of the gut and the microbiome in general in our body. So good nutrition, minimizing toxins, exercise, diet, and minimizing stress and emotional health, those will all be important. We can go a bit more into the diet side if you want to.
Yeah, well, look, I was going to say, I mean, that, two things. Firstly, I wanted to mention, of course, we can add to that list, very relevant to this show is that chemotherapy, of course, is pretty devastating to the microbiome. And so that must be also accounted for. If it's necessary, it's necessary, but we have to be aware of what we're doing, don't we?
Yeah, and just to say, it's not just chemotherapy either. It's also radiotherapy.
Yeah.
And it's also surgery. So all of the main treatments for cancer will have an impact on the gut microbiome and the microbiome in general. However, these treatments, of course, are very often necessary. So what we need to do, therefore, is to try as much as possible to rebalance the microbiome at the same time and afterwards. So that can be done by looking after the diet and lifestyle in general, in some of the ways I've said, but also by using probiotics.
Right. So I was just going to say, actually, that the kind of the flip side to a lot of what you said, I mean, many of those things that you've listed, they are choices we can make, and we can actually largely avoid the things that cause a problem. In other cases, we can't really. We might be in an area awash with EMFs, with electromagnetic radiation, or, you know, there may be polluted air, or whatever it is that we actually can't do much about. But we can always, on the plus side, do things to improve our situation and actually strengthen our microbiome to counter all of this attack. So, why don't you just go into that now? Tell us a bit in more detail about the kind of things you want to do if you want to actually get, you know, create a nice, healthy environment down there.
Okay. Well, there is so much we can do. So I have talked about the things that are damaging, but let's now talk about all the good things you can do. And diet is so, so important here. You know, as I said to you before, we have this core microbiome that doesn't change that much through our life. That's our resident microbiome. But then we have transient bacteria that come and go. Mm-hmm. And that changes depending on our diet and lifestyle. And these transient bacteria that come and go have an incredibly important role to play. So it's not just the ones that are always there that are important. It's the ones that come and visit us and stay a while and then disappear. Those are equally important, and they actually enhance the health of the ones that are always there. So what our diet can do is to make sure that we're getting good transient bacteria coming in. And so the foods that really, really most support our healthy bacteria are carbohydrates. So it's now, when it comes to carbohydrates, it gets a bit complex when we're talking about cancer, because very often people want to limit their carbohydrates, right? Because we know that high starches and high refined sugars can actually raise glucose levels, and that can have a pro-inflammatory effect and all sorts of things that we don't want with cancer. But when I'm talking about carbohydrates here, it's really the dietary fiber that's most important, that actually we don't digest so much. These are things that would normally pass through the gut undigested. But these dietary fibers can be fermented by our gut bacteria. Mm-hmm. And they provide foods. So they're like prebiotics, which means that they provide food for the good bacteria. So you're going to find that type of carbohydrate, that type of fiber in your plant foods, and particularly vegetables and fruits. So those foods that we know are good for us anyway are also good for our gut microbiome. On the other hand, refined starches and high sugars are not good for the microbiome. So it's the complex carbohydrates, particularly the vegetables and some fruit, that are going to be best. When it comes to the other macronutrients, protein is also beneficial for our microbiome, but we don't want too much of it. So moderate amounts of protein that comes from animal foods and things like pulses. And then fats as well are also good for us and can be good for our microbiome, but we again don't want too much. And it seems that the type of fat we eat has a part to play on altering a microbiome. So a diet very high in saturated fats doesn't seem to be so beneficial for our microbiome as a diet high in the essential fats, things like oily fish and nuts and seeds. Phytonutrients, so these are plant nutrients that have very, very important roles to play in our body generally. They have very powerful anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory effects. These are also very, very good for our microbiome. So things like the phenols that we find in berries, that type of things, and in herbs and spices, these have been shown to act as prebiotics again. So they act as foods for the good bacteria. So those are important. So that's, generally how a microbe-friendly diet would look. Lots of the plant foods, moderate protein, healthy fats, and lots of phytonutrients. Then we can put extra things into the diet. So I would certainly recommend that people include fermented foods in their diet. And particularly, there's some good research on kefir. And this is made, it's a very traditional food, and it's made from fermenting milk. It's a bit different from yogurt because the culture in kefir consists of yeast as well as bacteria. It produces very powerful probiotic food, so lots and lots of beneficial microorganisms in there. And there was recently a systematic review done on kefir in relation to cancer, and it found that kefir contained compounds that directly inhibited cancer growth and a very beneficial effect on our immune system.
How about that?
So there's lots of research on kefir, and it's something that I highly recommend. Now, I know some people don't want the dairy in their diet. You can make kefir with things like coconut milk or non-dairy milks. It's probably not quite as powerful, but you can do that. And then there are other fermented foods that are also going to be beneficial, like fermented pickles and cabbage, like sauerkraut, kimchi, that type of thing. So definitely they would be a part. So that's diet. Let me just quickly talk about a few other things. So exercise is also very, very good for our microbiome. And scientists aren't exactly sure why, but it's probably because exercise helps to reduce intestinal transit time, so keep the bowel contents moving. Exercise obviously helps to reduce stress. It helps improve our metabolic profile and reduce inflammation. And all of those things are going to help with our microbiome. So regular exercise, moderate exercise is good. Overtraining is not good because that can induce gastrointestinal distress and leaky gut. So we want moderate regular exercise rather than pushing ourselves to the limit. Stress, we've talked about, is really not good for the microbiome. So the flip side of that is going to be getting enough rest. And good quality sleep and relaxation are all going to be very good for our microbiome. And it works both ways, actually. Scientists know that there is a very strong link between the health of our gut microbiome and the health of our nervous system and our brain. And if we are managing stress and sleeping well and relaxing often, that promotes good, healthy microbiome. But on the flip side, a healthy microbiome will help us stay emotionally balanced and will actually help us handle stress better. So there's a two-way relationship there.
Right.
I talked a bit about the damage, the potential damage of electromagnetic radiation.
Yes.
But what we can do to counteract that is to spend time rebalancing our energies by being in nature, by being outside, by getting exposure to sunlight, by having, if possible, contact, direct contact with the earth. All of these things help to rebalance our energies, and that's going to have a positive effect on our microbiome. But being in nature generally is very, very good for our microbiome, because when we're outside and when we're in contact with the soil and plants and animals, then we're getting exposure to really healthy microorganisms. And, you know, we've evolved to be in touch with nature and to be outside a lot. Unfortunately, our modern life is spent, a lot of time is spent indoors, and you know, with windows shut, and sometimes we have to because it's cold, but you know, we're very insulated sometimes, and we don't have nearly so much exposure with plants and soil and natural compounds. You know, everything's synthetic now and sterilized. So contact with nature and contact with animals. You know, there's lots of research showing that when we have pets, that helps to improve our immune system and improve our microbiome. Obviously, we need to keep our pets healthy, and that helps us too. So all of that is good. Just one final thing is being around healthy people. Humans all have, as I said before, their own unique microbial fingerprint, and we actually have our microbes extending just beyond our body in a microbial cloud. And when we're mixing with healthy people, we're mixing with their healthy microbes. Now, of course, we can't always avoid being with people who have got a cold or aren't well in other ways, and we don't want to, you know, isolate ourselves from people. But generally speaking, if we can mix with healthy, happy people, then we're going to be mixing with other healthy microbes.
Fantastic. All right, that's a great picture. So very good guidance as to which direction to go. So we're getting towards the end of the show. There's a couple of questions I wonder if I can ask you, and you can give us just, we won't be able to go into them in much depth, but I'd like to hear something from you on them.
Okay.
One of them is that I believe the earliest experiences we have in life can be foundational to having a healthy microbiome. And I'm sure that parents who are listening will be interested to know what choices will help their children in this respect.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. What's done, particularly in those first few days and actually at the time of birth, is really important. Sometimes a cesarean birth is unavoidable and, you know, can be life-saving and it's necessary. But if it's possible to have a natural birth, then that is going to set the baby up with the best possible start in terms of the microbiome, because the baby is exposed to microbes coming through the birth canal. And that doesn't happen in the same way with a cesarean birth. Although now there have been some experiments done where they are with cesarean born babies using a vaginal swab from the mother to then cover the baby. So, you know, that may help in those situations.
Sure.
That's the first thing. Then the second thing that parents are always thinking about is how they feed their babies. And definitely we know that breastfeeding is going to be best for the microbiome. Human milk contains what are called human milk oligosaccharides, which are a collection of complex carbohydrates. And actually, they make up they're the third most abundant class of molecules in breast milk after fat and lactose. And it's thought that these oligosaccharides are very, very important chemicals for building up the microbiome in those first few days and weeks. So they're, again, acting as prebiotics, so they're feeding the good bacteria. So a natural birth and breastfeeding are going to be two of the very important early things. It's not always possible, as I said, and there are things that can be done if it's not possible. Limiting antibiotics for babies and children would also be another key thing. But as I said before, it's not always possible to avoid them, but it's just being really careful about using them only when they're really necessary. And then I think all the other things that we've talked about for children, such as healthy diet with a really diverse mix of foods. You know, sometimes children can be a bit fussy and, you know, we can't always get around that. But trying to encourage children to eat a wide, diverse range of foods, because diversity in our diet leads to diversity in our microbiome. And so the greater the range of vegetables that we have, the better. So that's something we can encourage from a young age. And then, you know, exercise, being in nature, allowing children to play in the mud, all those things are going to be really good.
Having pets.
And having pets, healthy pets. definitely.
Okay, so that's great. We'll have to leave that one there. This next one is probably enough for a whole show, but again, I'm going to have to ask you for a short answer. But yeah, just coming back to cancer, and of course, recently the blame for some types of cancer has been laid squarely at the door of bacteria and viruses. So how do they fit into this newly emerging picture of our relationship with bacteria and viruses?
So there are some microorganisms that we know increase cancer risk. I think one of the ones that we know about particularly is Helicobacter pylori, which increases stomach cancer risk. There's a strong association there. Other things like human papillomavirus increase cervical cancer risk. So we know that there are some pathogenic microorganisms that have a strong link to cancer. And actually, those two I mentioned are actually listed as class one carcinogens. Okay. However, the story is not that simple. And with Helicobacter pylori, for example, even though it increases stomach cancer risk, it lowers the risk of esophageal cancer. Mm. So it's always more complicated than it first seems.
Right.
And I think that, you know, if this is the last question, let me finish by saying that it's really about putting it all into context, not getting too scared about some of these pathogenic microorganisms, but understanding that it's the health of the body that will determine very often whether a microorganism will have a positive, a neutral, or a negative effect in our body. And I'm sure you've heard the quote that Louis Pasteur was supposedly to have said, whether it's true or not, that Claude Bernard, that was one of his contemporary scientists, was correct and that he was wrong, that the microbe is nothing, the terrain is everything. We know that sometimes microorganisms are so virulent that perhaps that will override the effects of the terrain. But generally speaking, if our terrain, that's our internal environment, is healthy and balanced, then the microorganisms will be behaving themselves and they will be in a more mutualistic balance in our body. If we've got a lot of toxins in the body, we haven't talked quite so much about that, but if there's a build-up of toxins in the body, then that creates an environment where pathogenic microorganisms are more able to thrive and more able to do damage. So I think the key message is for people with cancer or for anyone that wants to look after their microbiome is that we have to look after our terrain first of all. That's got to be the focus. And we do that through our diet and our lifestyle and our emotional health. And then that will naturally support the health of our microbiome. And it will mean that pathogenic microbes are much less likely to be able to take hold and have any damaging effects in the body.
Mm. So, I mean, it's very much the way that a lot of the discussion around health is going. If you talk about genes, they were just seen as, you know, things that you've got, and if you had bad genes, that was that. They now talk about epigenetics and the fact you have the genes are there, but who cares? If you're in good shape, they're not giving any trouble. And this is exactly the same message with these bacteria, isn't it? That if you're in good shape, they're not going to harm you.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. And it comes down to environment every time.
Yeah.
You know, how our environment is within the body, which is very directly linked, of course, to the environment outside of our body, that will determine how our genes behave, how our microbes behave.
Mm.
And the good news about that is we can change the environment within our body.
Yes.
You know, we have a lot of control over that.
Yes.
Through our diet, our lifestyle and our emotions again. So that's the really good news.
Brilliant. Well, look, Liz, that wasn't my last question, but you just answered my last question superbly, which was about the environment. I wanted to ask about that. So that's great. And that's a really good note to end on. It's very empowering and really interesting subject. Loads more we could talk about, clearly.
Yes.
But I think we've done reasonable justice. So thank you very much indeed.
That's a pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
The microbiome is a real frontier of research. It new data emerging at an incredible pace, so it's great to get up to date with Liz's help. Liz has created another presentation on the subject of the microbiome, aimed at a wide audience and available as a video on her website at www.bodysoulnutrition.co.uk/healing-insights. If you haven't got anything to jot that down now, don't worry. That link, along with other links to resources mentioned in today's show, are available on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk and click the link to the Yes to Life show on the homepage. Do make a point of joining me again, if you can, next week for another Yes to Life show, exploring the frontiers of integrative medicine for cancer. Goodbye. Thank you.